Now from the KSFR Newsroom at Noon looks at the top local news headlines for this Wednesday, July 10th. Our nearby Los Alamos National Laboratory is out with a new joint report with UNM that says many southwestern forests in the U.S. will disappear or be heavily altered by 2050. It goes on to project that by 2100, most conifer forests should be heavily disturbed, if not gone, as air temperatures rise in combination with drought. The study is centered on drought experiments in woodlands at both Los Alamos and the Civieta National Wildlife Refuge in central New Mexico that researchers say are more accurate than experiments conducted in greenhouses. Cutting New Mexico's number of high school dropouts in half would save $46 million in annual Medicaid spending, according to a new report from the Alliance for Excellent Education. That privately funded advocacy organization encourages the development of federal and national policies that support education reform. Their report was drafted with assistance by insurance giant State Farm. Stating that high school graduation contributes to a better educated and healthier populace, the report posits that New Mexico's Medicaid savings would be reduced by $5.8 million in costs related to heart disease, $12 million linked to obesity, $9 million related to alcoholism, and $12 million associated with tobacco use. At Santa Fe's city council meeting tonight, the governing body could create a new, albeit small, city park downtown. Some 240 square feet of city-owned land adjacent to the Water Street parking lot may soon become Cerletti Park, named for Tourism Secretary Mike Cerletti, who died last year. The area has become a hangout for vagrants and the scene of frequent harassment complaints. The park designation is seen as a move to boost public safety, and the area would also receive new landscaping. Councilors will also consider approving a citywide gun safety promotional campaign featuring public service announcements on buses and benches. An internal City of Santa Fe audit has found that an expensive data backup equipment purchase made in 2007 has not been used for its stated purposes. Some components of the near $600,000 technical package have never been used at all, and the IT system is now viewed as nearing its obsolescence. The matter is raising questions about the acquisition process, as the no-bid purchase never went into service as intended, and subsequently did not benefit the citizens of Santa Fe. Further investigation will try to determine if city and/or state purchasing codes were violated. Tomorrow's meeting of Santa Fe's Planning Commission will look at that request to redevelop the old Manderfield School across from Cristo Rey Church as a mixed-use studio, cafe, and residential complex. Some local residents have been voicing disapproval of the plan, saying such an enterprise is not appropriate for the Canyon Road neighborhood. The 1.4-acre property has been vacant for a number of years, with Santa Fe Schools now prepared to sell it to Claire and Michael Marist. The couple has said the purchase is contingent upon city approval of their new development plan. UNM's athletic venue, known as The Pit, could be rechristened to a name of your choice for a cost of $10 to $15 million. KOBTV reports that UNM's athletic department needs to generate new revenue to pay down some of the $40 million spent on the arena's renovation. If naming rights are purchased by a family, the name change would be permanent. If bought by a corporation, then the change would be only temporary. By order of Governor Martinez, flags across New Mexico are at half-staff today through Friday in honor of former Governor David F. Cargo, who died over the weekend at age 84. Cargo will lie in state in the Capitol Rotunda tomorrow. A funeral mass is scheduled for the Cathedral Basilica on Friday, with Cargo to be laid to rest in the Santa Fe National Cemetery. And weather for Santa Fe: partly sunny skies forecast for today through Friday, with highs in the upper 80s. A 40% chance for afternoon and evening thundershowers today, decreasing to 30% tomorrow. Overnight lows in the mid-60s. Meanwhile, the current Santa Fe temperature now 82 degrees. This is Dan Garrity for KSFR News. At Noon will continue in just a moment.
KSFR's Music Cafe series continues with A New York State of Mind, featuring New York musicians Michael Morreale on trumpet and Tony Ragusis piano, with Andy Zadrozny and John Trinacosta. Saturday, July 20th, 7 p.m. at the Museum Hill Cafe. To reserve your seat, call 428-1527. That's 428-1527 for a great evening of jazz as New York comes to New Mexico on July 20th.
At Noon now segues to today's feature stories. The instances of babies being born in New Mexico addicted to opiates has been rising over the years. In earlier days, the drug of choice may have been heroin, but the trend has been toward prescription opiates such as OxyContin. Without appropriate care, such opiate-addicted newborns face great challenges, and it's important that withdrawal treatment be administered as soon as possible. Joining us first to take a look at this issue is Brad Wharton, drug epidemiologist with the New Mexico Department of Health. Brad, give us an overview of this problem.
Well, the data for drug withdrawal syndrome in newborns, it's sometimes referred to as neonatal abstinence syndrome, the rates have really been going up. In 2000, there were 47 addicted babies statewide, and in 2011, there were 170. So the rates have gone up from 1.7 per 1,000 live births to 6.2 per 1,000 live births in 2011.
And is it indeed more a matter of prescription opioids as opposed to street drugs like heroin?
Yeah, combination of both, that's correct. And we know that in Santa Fe and in the north central part of the state, overdoses from these substances have really been increasing quite dramatically. We know that, like, Rio Arriba has a drug overdose death rate well above the state average and between 5 and 6 times higher than the U.S. rate. Santa Fe, Bernalillo, Taos County, all having very high rates. So we know that we have a high population of users in the Santa Fe area. And as a result, the drug neonatal withdrawal syndrome has also been increasing a lot. And I think one of the probably most important take-home messages really would be for women who are addicted to opioids should really seek prenatal care as soon as possible to, make an appointment with their health care provider. Also, La Familia in Santa Fe is starting up a Suboxone program for pregnant women. And so there really are measures that can be taken to prevent the syndrome if women seek prenatal care fairly early.
Does the Department of Health make an effort to stress to users that their habit be treated as a health issue?
Yes, healthcare providers are really, their main focus is the health of their client. They're really not interested in, turning people in to law enforcement or whatever. So if someone shows up for, and has a problem, the healthcare provider is there to provide treatment and help for the individual, or if they can't, to make a referral to someone who can give the proper help. And there are other resources such as La Familia, as I mentioned, and there are a number of Suboxone providers also in the area as well that can provide treatment.
Thank you, Brad Wharton with the Department of Health. We're going to be joined now by Dr. Wendy Johnson with La Familia. Doctor, what approach do you take to minimize any law enforcement concerns a drug-using expectant mother may have and instead refocus them toward receiving help?
Well, I think that you've sort of hit the issue on the head. The problem is that outreach to this population is very difficult because although a lot of these women do come to La Familia and we see these women, and I can say that most of them are very concerned about the health and welfare of their children. The addiction just gets in the way of their judgment about how best to serve that need. So, of course, these folks are often, especially if they're using illegal drugs or even if they're using prescription drugs that they obtain illegally, have other fears about getting their children taken away from them, about themselves being put in jail. And so there's a lot of motivations for them not to come in and seek prenatal care. But overwhelmingly, our experience at La Familia is most of these women do, in the end, really care strongly about the welfare of their children. And once they do get into prenatal care, we can work with them. We can work with them to get them into programs. We can work with them to limit the detrimental effects of their addiction on their pregnancy. So exactly what you said, the key really is getting these women connected with care as early as possible.
And we've been speaking about rendering the proper care to newborns with opiate addictions, but can you speak to any of the attendant risks during the pregnancy itself?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of risks that are directly related to the opiate, and there's risks that are related to the kind of lifestyle that people that are suffering from severe addictions often have. If you're suffering from a severe addiction and you're using all your money to feed your addiction, you're not eating well. You're not taking care of your body in general. And so a lot of these pregnancies are afflicted by problems with intrauterine growth, with problems with other kinds of problems in utero that the baby might suffer, because in general the health of the mom isn't what it should be. The nutrition isn't what it should be. And then there's effects of the drug itself that can also affect growth and affect the well-being of the baby in utero.
Is there any evidence, even if anecdotal, that such pregnancies are at greater risk of spontaneous miscarriage?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely true.
And what about at the actual time of birth, a more difficult delivery?
I'm not sure the delivery of it itself is more difficult necessarily, but certainly, you know, you've probably talked to others about this, but there is a withdrawal period. So babies that are born addicted to opiates have the effects of that addiction and go through withdrawal just like adults do when they're addicted to drugs. And so that has to be managed in a hospital and has to be managed very carefully and slowly to minimize the effects of that withdrawal. And generally that means giving the babies some kind of opiate and slowly withdrawing it, rather than withdrawing it really dramatically all at once, i.e. when they deliver. So that's why it's very important to recognize these moms before delivery and to get them into good treatment. If possible, to get them onto a less harmful medication like Suboxone, which is used to treat addiction. And it's less harmful when babies are born on Suboxone. The withdrawal is much faster. So babies born on heroin or addicted to heroin or addicted to other prescription opiates, usually the withdrawal lasts several weeks in the hospital. And Suboxone could last maybe a week or two. And so that's a big difference.
And any final thoughts you have today on this topic?
I just want to encourage everybody, and especially in Santa Fe and New Mexico, where we have such a severe problem with this. I think almost everybody knows, if you look at the statistics, almost everybody in New Mexico knows somebody who's taking prescription opiates, whether legally or illegally. We prescribe a lot of prescription opiates in this state. We have double the national average of death from overdose from prescription opiates. And the children addicted to opiates is just one of the side effects and fallout from this overall issue. And I would just encourage everybody in our community to pay attention to your friends and family who might be suffering from an addiction. It's very hard to see. And if you have a suspicion, talk to your friends and family about it and help them seek medical care and mental health care and addiction services. And we're here at La Familia, we're working to expand those services. In the next several months, we plan to have many more services for pregnant women who are addicted, and in general for folks in the community. So stay tuned for that.
Dr. Wendy Johnson with La Familia, many thanks for joining us here at noon on KSFR, which will continue in just a moment.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Greenfire Times, a new monthly publication focusing on all things green, including health, healing, organic foods, nutrition, permaculture, sustainability, green-collar jobs, and renewable energy. Greenfire Times is distributed at newsstands from Albuquerque to Taos. More information and an online edition can be found at greenfiretimes.com.
Clouds, rain, forests, watersheds. These have always been essential and always will be. What is Santa Fe County doing to protect and restore its essential watershed? Tune in Thursday from 4 to 5 to Living on the Edge for a discussion with local watershed activist Mike Alani, State Representative Carl Trujillo, and me, David Bacon, as we look into the future of Santa Fe County's watershed and what we can do to restore and protect it for the future. This Thursday, 4 to 5, Living on the Edge.
20 minutes past the hour as At Noon continues. In recent news from the Los Alamos National Lab, scientists there say that wildfires may contribute to global warming more than previously thought. They've studied measurements taken after the devastating 2011 Los Conchas fire that raged around Los Alamos. It seems that the actual carbon-containing particles emitted by fires are very different than those used in current computer models. In reality, the particles are more like tar balls that absorb more sunlight than previously thought. And that, say the scientists, points to a greater warming of the atmosphere by wildfires than current estimates show. Joining us now to talk more about the findings is LANL senior scientist Dubé. Sir, give us your overview of some of the new research.
Okay, yeah. To start off with, wildfire emissions and all aerosol emissions from combustion activity are complex. Currently, models treat wildfires as two types of particles. One is soot, that is black, and the other is smoke, or organic carbon, that is white. And so when you treat those emissions, what happens is the black particles absorb sunlight, causing a heating effect, whereas the smoke particles or white particles, or organic particles, scatter sunlight and they create a cooling effect. So in current models, these effects cancel out, and you basically get a almost null effect from the net emissions from wildfires. What we found studying the Los Conchas fire in Los Alamos in 2011 was that there are actually more types of particles. In fact, we found there are spherical particles called tar balls that are overwhelmingly dominant. They're 10 times greater than the soot, and these are brownish compounds that can absorb sunlight and cause warming. The other thing we found was that soot particles, which are black, get also coated by organic particles, thin coatings and thick coatings, and these coatings act like lenses. So they're like focused light, and they increase the absorptivity of black carbon. So that's another warming effect. So the findings imply that these particles, tar balls and coated soot, will result in a much more warming effect of the wildfire emissions. I think we are working with modelers to begin to include this complexity. The other thing we did was soot and emissions are like a brew of very complex structures, but we found that if we had three or four types of these structures, not just two, but three or four interacting structures, we could probably better predict what the wildfire emissions are doing.
You know, in recent years, we've observed some of our local fires producing what's known as a pyrocumulus cloud, which, for all purposes, resembles a typical thunderhead. Are the particles you're talking about among those creating those cloud formations?
Well, a lot of the what happens in pyrocumulus, and Los Alamos also has models that study this. It's a different problem. It's a small-scale problem. But, yeah, these particles do matter. So when you have big wildfires, they generate heat, which generates buoyancy, which basically creates hot air that rises, and then water can condense because fires have a lot of water coming out of them. But these particles do matter because these big pyrocumulus towers that happen, during fires here can collapse. You know, they can fall down, and when they do collapse, what happens, the fire spreads laterally, so it can actually really dramatically accelerate the fire spread. Fortunately, it didn't happen here, last big fire, but soot actually is an important the mechanism involves soot. So when soot goes high up, then it can transfer heat. It can do that. But these are different problems. I think we were more concerned about what these wildfires are doing to global warming.
And as we speak of wildfires contributing to global warming, massive wildfires would burn uncontrolled before the days of human activity associated with climate change. This phenomenon then would be an example of natural causes of warming?
So let me step back. This study does not, refute that greenhouse gases like CO2, methane, nitrous oxide are increasing from anthropogenic activity and forcing climate. So I think I have to be careful that this is not saying that global warming is not happening. All it's saying is when we try to understand it, we have to include other things, fire emissions and all that. So that's the first thing. The second thing is you're right. In the past, fires do happen and have modulated, climate regionally and globally. But the key fact is that we, especially in the U.S., have been managing forests. So what has happened is we've been suppressing fire pretty amazingly for a while. And what that results in very, very dense forests. So these are not natural densities that are sustainable. So what is happening now is by managing forests, we have created a lot of fuel density. So when a fire happens, it gets out of control and very intense. Now we are continuing to manage forests, as you can see from all the firefighting activity in the U.S. and elsewhere. Now, what will happen is that as climate changes, things get warmer and drier. You will eventually be unable to fight some of these fires. We're already running into it. So models predict that in the next 30, 40, 50 years, the fire frequency will keep on increasing, and we will not be managing it. So the fact that active management of fire suppression in the last quarter century or more has resulted in very dense strands is part of the issue. And global warming will interact with that, and you'll get a lot of these fires that will eventually become unmanageable. So I think they're coupled, and I think in the past, since we didn't fight fires, there was thinner forests, and there's a natural ecology of the cycle going on. That now, but in the future, our models predict, and we think that fires will really, increase.
So as we move forward in this era of climate change, which is expected to produce more instances of wildfire, we therefore have an example of a feedback loop compounding the problem. Much the same as the melting tundra in northern latitudes allow greenhouse gases to escape from previously frozen soils, yes?
Right. So man triggers and nature amplifies. So, the cause fundamental is greenhouse gases, and then these fires and all that are amplifiers, in the system. So you're right. It's a coupling between anthropogenic greenhouse gases that are increasing warming and storminess and drought and stuff like that. And I think so. You're right. It's a feedback. So when we warm the climate, there are a lot of natural feedbacks, including fires and the tundra, that are a cause of concern. They could amplify the human effect rather than buffer it. So nature we assume nature should be forgiving and benign. Unfortunately, nature is the way it is.
And of your research at the lab, will it now serve to rewrite computer modeling for future climate research?
No, nature is very complicated. So we have built computer models, especially at Los Alamos and the Department of Energy, over two or three decades. And these models get more and more complex. But the nice thing about it is our findings, which are primarily experimental, are being shared with the modelers here. And I presume in the next year or so, they will include them. So there's a dialogue, healthy dialogue going between measurements and modeling people. It's very complex, so this iteration is critical. So I don't think it will revamp it. It will iteratively refine it and improve the models.
Lanel Senior Scientist Dubay, many thanks for joining us here at noon on KSFR. Taking a look at the current temperature in Santa Fe at 28 minutes past the hour, it's 83 degrees, on its way to a high in the upper 80s, along with a 40% chance for afternoon and evening thundershowers. KSFR News reporter Marion Cox has been working on this next story from the Hondo Fire Department. It has to do with the ISO rating that insurance companies use for rate and management maintenance. For the area served by the Hondo Fire Department, the last rating took place 15 years ago, leaving property owners with high premiums. But that may soon change. Here's Marion Cox's report.
We're speaking this morning with Chief Tom Chilton of the Hondo Volunteer Fire Department. We understand that earlier this year in March that the Insurance Service Organization, also known as ISO, conducted an evaluation of your readiness as a volunteer fire department. Can you tell us what that was all about and what the status of that evaluation is?
The ISO rates fire departments for the purpose of determining what the relative risk is of the properties insured by various insurance companies. So they're doing this on behalf of many, many different insurance companies.
But as important as this ISO evaluation is, it's been 15 years since the Hondo Volunteer Fire Department was rated. Is that correct?
That is correct, and that's fairly typical because it's a single organization covering essentially the entire United States.
And take us through what that evaluation involved.
A massive amount of paperwork that they request, having to do with our training, our equipment, has to do with things out of our control, such as the dispatch system that the county uses, the water supply that we have available to us, the number of hydrants, the location of those hydrants, lots of different things. The thing that was so successful for us most recently was a test, timed test of a particular procedure using fire trucks and drafting water out of a reservoir and flowing water at a certain volume. They timed that. It's called a 5-minute evolution, and we did exceptionally well there. We even surprised ourselves. This particular test literally is testing your ability to do a series of routine but complicated procedures in a very short period of time. And they're related to the kinds of things that we would do at a structure fire. So it's a practical test, but you only get one chance at it.
So aside from the fact that it's been 15 years since the Insurance Service Organization, ISO, came and evaluated you, and aside from the fact that it's been an anxious fire season for many Santa Fe County residents, why is this important for individual property owners to pay attention to?
The each insurance company uses the ISO rating as a guideline for what to charge for the annual premium to insure that property.
If the Hondo Volunteer Fire Department scores high on this ISO evaluation, that it might have any impact on individual property owners' homeowners' insurance premiums?
Yes. The people who will be affected in the Hondo Fire District most greatly will be those who are beyond 1,000 feet of a fire hydrant, but within 5 driving miles. Properties in that category have a rather poor rating right now. It is a 9, and a lower number is better. The worst you can get is a 10. They're a 9 right now, which means they're paying almost maximum insurance rates. We anticipate that for that group of people, beyond 1,000 feet of a fire hydrant, but within 5 driving miles, that number will drop to, and again, lower is better, that will drop to a 5 and possibly a 4. The reduction in insurance premiums should be somewhere between 30% and 50%, according to the state fire marshal.
And indeed, your office and the county have guesstimated that with a good score, a conservative estimate of the total reduction in insurance premiums for this geographic area over the next 10 years could total as much as $4 million?
That is correct, and that may be a conservative number.
But it really will have a direct impact on property owners. When do you think you're going to get the results of the evaluation that was conducted in March of this year?
The ISO representative told me that that would be mailed at the
So we will check back in with you in early August. Keep our fingers crossed, and we thank you so much for taking time on a very busy day to talk with us at KSFR.
Certainly. My pleasure.
That was Marion Cox for KSFR News. At Noon continues in just a moment.
Ebullient mezzo-soprano Susan Graham performs a title role of Jacques Offenbach's riotously funny The Grand Duchess of Gerolstein this summer at the Santa Fe Opera. All's fair in love and war games at the Gerolstein Military Academy, with its dashing uniformed cadets and apple-cheeked local sweethearts cheering them on, with the Academy's patroness, the Grand Duchess herself, in sexy pursuit. Far from being a lady of a certain age, this Grand Duchess is an amorous aristocrat with an eye for Fritz, her favorite young cadet, sung by the dynamic American tenor Paul Appleby. Soprano Anya Matanovic completes the love triangle. Emmanuel Vuillaume conducts. The Santa Fe Opera's Grand Duchess of Gerolstein promises lots of laughter and fun. Learn more about this production and the entire upcoming season by visiting santafeopera.com or by calling 800-280-4654. That's 800-280-4654. This message is sponsored by the Santa Fe Opera, a tax-exempt organization.
12:35 here in the KSFR newsroom, and time now to spend 60 seconds with our resident curmudgeon, Christopher Hagen.
I like buffalo wings. I don't eat them a lot, but when I do, I enjoy the experience. It's been, a couple of years, and I still miss the closing of arguably Santa Fe's home of the best wings in town, the Green Onion. I haven't had a chance yet to try the new Buffalo Wild Wings, but I will once the crowds diminish from mob to throng. But the reason I bring up buffalo wings is that next to barbecue ribs, buffalo wings are probably the messiest food eaten by hand there is. And that means messy napkins, really, really messy napkins. And quite frankly, disgusting-looking messy napkins. I'm talking primarily paper napkins. I'm pretty much always felt sorry for the waiters and waitresses who, actually have to pick up my messy napkins. My thinking started to evolve to the thought that waiters and waitresses don't get paid enough to touch the paper napkins I have vigorously soiled. So I then throw my napkins away myself. I just wanted to wipe my hands clean of that. For KSFR, I'm Christopher Hagen.
And Dan Garrity back with you now in the KSFR newsroom with just time enough to tell you that will conclude today's edition of At Noon, KSFR's extended noon news hour. Many thanks to my contributing colleague today, Marion Cox. We'll be back with more news of and for New Mexico for you tomorrow. And as always, we hope you join us.